Well, this one is paradoxically the alone. Plotinus called it the alone. He talked about the flight of the alone to the alone. And you see, what is the purpose of life, Richard? What is the purpose? What's life all about? And as I see it, and as the great mystics saw it, all the great religions, the purpose of life is a simple one. It is conscious union with our source. And our source offers the incredible privilege of union with him or it or her. As a, you know, as Eckhart said, God's in, I'm out, is what he said. Eckhart puts it very beautifully. He says, put on your jumping shoes. Not Adidas jumping shoes. Put on your, he was a medieval. He put on your jumping shoes and jump into God. So it's jumping from your appearance to your reality. Put on your jumping shoes and jump into God. The great Dominican that he was, that's his way of putting it. I love that. Well, it's our business is to jump into the place we never left. And if you want to do anything well, do it from the centre, from where you are, not from where you ain't.
So who jumps into the source?
I do. I do. And of course, you don't jump once and for all, you keep jumping. It's a jump that has to... It's a jump that refashions the jumper. You are transformed en route. And you see, you leave old Douglas behind, you must, because you jump into the alone. And Douglas is one of the many. And thank God the Douglas doesn't arrive at the centre. It's the alone that arrives at the alone. God has access to God. Douglas is left behind. Otherwise, this is devilish hubris, pride. It's the alone that arrives at the alone. Only God makes it all the way to God, you see. But we are, by grace, taken home. On his back, really, so to say, we arrive home by grace, to be the alone. And the purpose of life is conscious union with its source. It's marvellous. Anything else is just an unworthy substitute for that.
Doesn't this make the hair stand up on the back of your neck?
Should do, shouldn't it? Should do. I think it's amazing and wonderful. And you go around the world, you know, blurbing about this, you know, blowing your top about this. People say, oh, come off it. What are you talking about? It's discouraging, isn't it? However.
What about the miracle of being? Creating itself.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the pieces of evidence of the that one is by grace united to one source is that, as I see it, there's one thing about our source that is so incredible and so realizable by us. That it's obviously not by us, but by him, and that it is the sharing in the thoughts and experience of the one. And that is what, there shouldn't be anything at all. There should not be anything at all. As Martin Heidegger said, you know, it's not what the world is, but that it is, which is amazing, extraordinary. Impossible, really. The Gnostics used to talk about the self-originating one. I mean, think of yourself as a little boy, little Richard, talking to his mum. And little Richard says to his mum, "Who made the world?" And mother says, "Come off it, you know God made the world, Richard. You know that." And you have a little think and scratch your head. And you say, "Who made God?" Your mother, if she's sensible, says, "I guess he made himself." And if she's silly, she'll say, "Don't ask silly questions." Supposing she says, "He made himself." And you do another thing. "You mean to say there was nothing, nothing, then, just dark night, nothing, nothing. Absolutely nothing." Up he popped. "Oh, that was clever. How did he do that?" "Just got up to himself, invented himself, made himself, nothing, for no reason, no help, help. God, that's impossible." It's happened, and with what energy and flair the self-originating one originates itself. Now, that vision, and to share in that joy and that wonder, that isn't... that isn't a human experience. I, for my money, to share in that is to share in the thrill and joy of God himself as self-originating. I think it's real worship, you see, because what I find so worshipful is the one who has, should I call it, the handy knack of self-origination. And there have been one or two modern philosophers who've seen this. Wittgenstein, for instance. It's not what the world is, not what the universe is, but that it is, which is mystical. And even in the Dark Ages, in the court of Charlemagne, you know, in 1900 AD or 850 AD, you had John Erigena, who said... it's not what God is that matters, it's that he is. That. And that's amazing. Now, that seems to me to be participation in the very mind of the Creator. And little old Douglas is quite incapable of anything like that. But by grace and union with the one I am, I enjoy that. And I say, this is so marvellous. And it's so optimistic, Richard, because, gosh, after that, I mean, the creation of a billion universes, all going strong, is chicken feed after that, isn't it? It's all a matter of routine after that. After self-origination, this is a matter of routine. I think this is extremely optimistic. Tell me what's impossible after that, after inventing oneself. So I say to the Almighty, gosh, that was brilliant, that was brilliant. Staggering. And I think, I'm quite sure, that the Almighty is as bowled over by it as I am. In fact, my being bowled over is part of his being bowled over, in fact. Integral with it.
Do you believe this vision is going to get around?
Do I believe this vision?
This vision is going to get around.
Yes, I do. I do. The truth will prevail. Maybe it won't get very far on this planet, maybe. But as I said before, there are many eggs in the cosmic basket, aren't there? There are many planets there. I'm a universe in which lies win and truth fails is unthinkable, yes. Insofar as it's true, it will survive somewhere, somewhen. Insofar as it's rubbish, and in places it is pretty rubbishy, I'm sure. Insofar as it is diluted with Douglas nonsense. Why it will perish and deserves to perish. Otherwise it won't.
You obviously are passionate about this work.
Yes.
How do you see yourself in history being given this job to do?
I think God makes use of most lousy instruments, and I think it's because the instrument knows it's lousy, it's available. Because if I think I can make it as Douglas, then I'm not going to be much use. I think it's because of one's very inadequacy that one is chosen, in a way. Because you really haven't got haven't got anything really to lean on as a person. But I really must confess, I think, that this is the message that we need. And I haven't, in my reading, found anyone who said it, other than myself and friends. I find echoes and encouragements all over the place. But this method of experimentation, really, is an enormous, wonderful privilege to have been given the job.
As a spiritual teacher, what do you see your role in history to be?
It can be described in many ways, I think. One way which is useful is to point out, my role is to point out, elaborate the difference, the astronomical difference between what we look like and what we are, between the third person, our appearance and our reality. So the study of, the celebration of first personhood, I would see as my role. Another way is to expose the multiple hallucinations that we suffer from as members of society, and to correct them by means of experimentation. I don't know, I think, Richard, in a way, one just does what one has to and let other people find names for it. I don't think it's up to me to characterize it and put it in a big social or historical context. Other people do that. I just have to do what have to get on with the things that excite me and move me and delight me and fill me with joy. And let other people place the thing in history if it deserves a place in history.
You clearly see this as a breakthrough in consciousness, a breakthrough in terms of communicating this inner vision.
Well, I do. I really do, I must admit. I think this is revolutionary. Because it's a reversal of everything, you see. It's not just a tarting up of the way we see things, or a revision, or an improvement, or adjustment of our common or garden consciousness. It is setting everything on its head, really. It's upside downing of everything. I mean, you see me as limited, small, contained in a box. I see myself as out of the box. You see I'm looking out of two eyes, I'm looking out of one eye. You see I'm face to face with Catherine or anyone. I've never been face to face with anybody. You see me moving around in the world. I don't move around in the world, the world moves around in me. Everything is upside down. And, I mean, it doesn't mean that Douglas is unreal, but he's the opposite of what I am. He's, the appearance is not somewhat dissimilar to its reality. It's the diametric opposite. And that needs saying, and it needs living. It needs sharing. It needs saying. It needs sharing. It needs living.
This is a profound letting go.
Well, it is. Letting go, letting be is peripheral, what is peripheral, and stop pretending to make it central. Let go of what isn't here. Let it go to its proper place. Douglas go to his proper place. And Douglas is very important for me, and less so for other people, but he is important, as is importance. And the universe is different because of him, just as it's different because of Richard. The universe will never recover from Richard Lang, will it? It can't. You're an essential ingredient of the cosmic pudding. But let that go to where it belongs and be where you are. And where you are is magnificent beyond belief, marvellous, amazing, hair-raising in a way, as you said.
What special powers do you have as first person?
Well, I think that when you contact your source, strange things happen. And you do get powers, I think, of some kind. And it is a trap and a tragedy when you start trying to cultivate them. Marvelous things happen. In fact, miracles happen, I think. In fact, I think your life really consists of miracles in a way. But if you go for them and say, I'm how powerful I am, I'm a wizard, you know, and so on, I think this is absolute disaster. They're called siddhis in India, aren't they? To cultivate siddhis is devilish in the end. It's using the best for the cultivation of the worst. But I do think that surprises happen, extraordinary things happen when you contact their source. Miracles happen. Yes, they do. And in an extraordinary way, you don't know what to do in a situation. You give up. You feel absolutely hopeless and you hand over to the one you are, and it gets coped with in a fantastic way. Now, don't take credit, but be thankful. If you take credit as a person, that's dangerous. But if you're thankful, that's good. Note it, be thankful. Don't brag about it. Don't advertise it. Trust.
Does this awareness give you peace?
Well, I think it takes you to a place that is peace. I suppose I'm so very concrete and physical in my what I understand to be the case. I mean, if you want to be hot, you go to the equator. If you want to be cold, you go to the North Pole or South Pole. If you want to be peaceful, you go to places peaceful anyway, regardless of whether you recognize it or not. And where's the place of peace? The place of peace is nearer to me than Douglas. It's really at my center. here is the everything that I need awaits me if only I look for it, see it, trust it. This is a place of peace. Same with joy, love, all those things. I say, it's a great question for me, really practical question is, where do they hang out? If I'd rather not die, I'd rather not, really. Well, go with it, go where death can't. Because there's nothing to destroy. It's like that.
In what sense is this the place of joy?
Well, I think joy is a strange thing. It's called Ananda in India, isn't it? And joy has various levels. I mean, you can have joy over, you know, winning the pools or something like that, very temporary and so on. I think all lesser joys are kind of really derived from the basic one joy, which is the joy of the one at centre, who is his own, its own origin and inventor. I think all lesser joys are real joys. I mean, no joy of eating caramel custard. I mean, joy of all sorts of things that we do appreciate, like the colour of the lobelia out there, which is absolutely extraordinary, I think. That's a joy which derives from the joy at our centre, which is there. We have the idea we've got to make ourselves happy. I think happiness is a place and is nearer to you than your misery.
What implications has seeing who you really are got for sex?
Well, I think the... this Richard, D.H. Lawrence, you know, was a pioneer, wasn't he, 75 years ago. He was very keen on shifting from sex in the head, which was an ersatz and no good, and wasn't even good sex, you know, to where sex belonged. And I think that what happens is when we're very, very little, we're centered in our guts here, in our heart and our guts. This is, a baby is centered here, is living from here. And then we go to school and become educated in some degree, and clever, and we, you know, get in a profession and become smart. And our centre of gravity moves up to our head, and we start living from here. Well, the same with sex. Sex really belongs down in this region here, but when we become members of a club, our centre of gravity moves up, and we suffer from sex in the head, which is, you know, kind of we're out there peeping in at our bedroom. Through the keyhole, you know, what the butler saw, that kind of stuff. We're out there looking at ourselves being sexy or something. And that won't work, that won't do. And I think, really, when we do our homework and really start living from here, from who we are, our centre of gravity really goes down. And sex is something that becomes natural again and delightful and really important. From its proper region. What's wrong is sex in the head. And D.H. Lawrence was, Lady Chatterley's lover and so on, was about that.
Douglas, what do you hope to achieve in the rest of your life?
In the rest of my life? What do I hope to achieve? I hope to achieve more more sense of not achieving, you know, more reliance, more leaning back on the one. I don't hope to achieve that. I really don't have anything I want particularly, not really. I'd like the work I'm doing, the things I'm doing, working on at the moment, to get around and share them, those things with people. But I have to say, that's attachment. And this is detachment, you know, when you come back. Detachment. If you start saying, I want this and I want that and the other, you know, it's a little guy there who has all these wants. At centre, what remains to be? I mean, the world is yours. The world is in you, the movement of the world. You are the unmoved movement of the world. You are the, as Traherne says, clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars. The world is in you, you know, where you're coming from. It's not wanting to achieve anything. I think you want to see that all is achieved more and more.
How would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be forgotten as Douglas and remembered for what he was said through him, which is what we've been talking about. I know you quizzed me about my early life and all that stuff by the sea and, you know, and collecting fossils and all that stuff and Plymouth Brethren stuff. It's really exceedingly marginal to what we're talking about, isn't it? That's not worth really going on about, is it? So I would like to be forgotten as regards that stuff, or not remembered too much about that stuff, is what one shares, which is what one hopes will last, and I'm sure will last, insofar as it's valid.
Douglas, who have been your great inspirations?
Great inspiration. Oh, gosh. Of all... spiritual authorities, who do I value most? Oh, I couldn't tell you, really. Well, I would say the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount, the Paul... Paul was a great, great, great man. Eckhart and Catherine of Genoa, Eckhart. Risbrook, a very, very, very great man. He was a Flemish medieval. The Buddha, you know. The Upanishads, which are anonymous, enormously inspiring. Written 600 years before Christ, most of them. And how wonderful. I don't think I can award marks to them. They're complimentary. I used to teach for Cambridge University. As I told you, I used to teach comparative religion. And this was my theme. The great religions were, and the great teachers of great religions were, the great religions were, stemmed from one root, and were limbs of a tree, really. And at their best, at their worst, they were loggerheads and rubbish. At their best, they were complementary. It was an indivisible revelation. They needed one another. Each religion stressed something. For instance, Hinduism, oneness. Stressed oneness. Buddhism stressed attention, mindfulness. Judaism, justice. Christianity, self-giving love. Islam, surrender. Now they're all essential. All essential.
Thank you very much, Douglas. It's been great talking to you.
I would, if I might, add a footnote. The words are incidental. The real nitty-gritty of what we've been on about is what we do. You know, teachers, all teachers would agree, we learn by doing. And what we learn by, what I learn by, what I have to share is a doing thing. Active, it really is active. And this is an active thing, you see. And putting on my glasses, and I do beg you to put on your two glasses and see they become a monocle. And you're looking out to the one eye which is as wide as the world, and is not a human eye. That human eye you see in a mirror, this eye which is as wide as the world, that's not a human eye. That is the eye of the one seer and all beings that the Upanishad spoke of. So it's the doing of these things which matters. I've indicated only a very few things to do, like seeing your single eye and pointing to who you are. But I would add, when you get face to face with someone, anyone, someone you love, for instance, begin with someone you love. What a joy it is to see you're not face to face with that one. How could you be? You get opposite to someone, even if somebody you don't love very much, and see how impossible it would be to have your face and that face in the same eyeful. You've got to have one or the other, haven't you? You're sort of alone in the mirror or that one. The face-to-face thing is the biggest lie that ever was, and it's universal. Now, stop it, I say. Get in front of someone and see you can't be face-to-face with that one. We use a paper bag to make this clear. You don't need a damn paper bag. Just get in front of the face and see you've got it. And you're empty. You've got it because you're empty for it. These are doing things. And when you're in your car, just look and see what's moving. Be truthful and see that the car you think you're driving, what you, in fact you're driving, is not a car, it's the world. You're driving the universe. And Aristotle, great Greek philosopher, defined God as the unmoved mover of the world. Well, by grace, that is what you are, Senda. The awesome truth of this. Gosh. This is meditation. And meditation for me is meditation for life and marketplace, highly practical. You say, is it practical? It is. Because if you're doing a lot of driving, I recommend this to you. You know, if you want to drive well and without tension and with pleasure and without tiring yourself very much or at all, drive England, drive France. It's much better than driving your Clio. This is so practical, you see. I do recommend it as practical. It's childlike, it's obvious, it's amusing, it's fun too. You see, this thing is so amusing and entertaining. I think if you want to be entertained, if you want to discover that God Almighty has a terrific sense of humour, you know, then come home and enjoy the humour. Yeah. Do it. Test it. Don't believe me. Word I've put out. Don't believe any of it, test it. Is it true? Am I mad? Am I talking rubbish? Or is it true? And if it's true, try it. Give it a whirl. As Eckhart says, what have you got to lose? What have you got to lose? By giving it a whirl. And I think you'll find it's intensely 100% practical. And if you're getting old, you know, what's the medicine? Just live where there's nothing to get old. The chap in the mirror is aging rapidly. indicates over here. And if you want to enjoy the brilliance of the world, you know, when you were very young, the world was, the colours, they sang, and they were absolutely marvellous. Sounds, music, and, you know, smell of mimosa, for instance, in spring, colours, blue particularly, I don't know why. The colours were so marvellous, the tastes were so pungent, you know, so marvellous. Smells. If you want to regain that sensual vividness, come home, and you will regain it. To look at those lobelia in bright sunshine is for me just, you know, amazing every time. Absolutely amazing. I can't get over it. This is a way. It's not a world-rejecting way, it's a way of discovering the universe, of discovering the world. So, there we are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. I loved your questions.